Thank you very much for coming. I'm Jude Brown, the Director of the University of Cambridge Centre for Gender Studies, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the second of Baroness Helena Kennedy's lecture series entitled The Illusion of Inclusion, Women and the Law. And this is hosted by CRASH and the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, the Humanitas lecture series. So last night we heard of the gender inequities in the legal profession and the ways in which the gendered interpretations of the law have moulded its evolution. And tonight's lecture is entitled Women's Rights and Women's Woes, Who Say Human Rights Are Universal? So please join me in welcoming Helena Kennedy.
Thank you, Jude. There used to be a column in Country Life, not a magazine to which I subscribe, I should add, but it invited a guest contributor to put together an imaginary dinner party. And actually, I was on an occasion asked if I'd like to do this, and I did. And the imaginary dinner party meant that you could bring together all the historic characters that you wanted, or people living, anybody you liked, and bring them together in a dinner party and explain why and what you thought might happen. And when I was given the opportunity, I had very great fun seating together Robert Burns, the great Scottish poet, with the wife of Bath. I thought that could be good. I had imagined the sexual electricity and the bodiness that could be rather fun with Robert Burns putting his hand on her knee or up her skirt. But anyway, you know, I had Clarence Darrow. Clarence Darrow was a great American lawyer. He took part in a very famous case, which was about evolution versus creationism, and he was representing a man who had been prosecuted for daring to suggest that evolution should be taught in the schools, or was being sued for that. And then I was going to have Ruby Wax, comedienne extraordinaire, but also a student of neuroscience. She's actually doing a master's in neuroscience just now in Oxford, and often comes to stay in my house at my college. I also had Bertha Wilson, a great woman judge on the Canadian Supreme Court, Scottish in origin, so I had a soft spot for her, and a feminist and a truly remarkable person, and Samuel Beckett, that wonderful writer and Irishman. It was a great fun game to play, but the real dinner party to which I would have liked to have received an invite was before I was born. In 1947, Eleanor Roosevelt sent out invitations to jurists from around the world to join her in New York at her Washington Square apartment for dinner. For dinner, and there to follow a set of seminars in the days thereafter. Her husband, FDR Roosevelt, the great wartime president, was dead. But she had become a great national institution in her own right, having been such an important figure through the Depression and the war, and contributed many of the ideas that were part of the New Deal. Her dinner party list included many of the greatest lawyers and judges in the world, and her purpose was ambitious, ambitious beyond imagining, to explore the creation of new law that could bind all nations in a commitment to the fundamental rights that all people, whoever they might be, were entitled to enjoy. Never again would the guardians of legal systems be able to wash their hands of responsibility for egregious wrongs that took place on their watch. The invitees to this dinner party were not just lawyers from many nations and legal traditions, they were also from different faiths and different ideologies. There was a Confucian from China, a Brazilian Catholic, a Soviet communist, a Lebanese Christian, a Hindu from India. There was a Canadian jurist and a British lawyer. The civil system of Europe was represented, as was the common law system, and so too Sharia law. The question was whether global law was possible. Early on in the discussion, it became clear that nations prefer their own legal systems to be rooted in their own culture and traditions. So if not global law, were there universal values? which could create, if you like, a template of rights which would be able to inform and enrich national legal systems, acting as a sort of gauge against which national systems should be measured. So the question was asked, are there universal values around which all nations could forge a settlement? No doubt those who sat at that dinner table in 1947 wanted harmony for an end to the seemingly interminable record of discord between human beings that had gone before. Two world wars in 50 years haunted that room. There had just been an attempt to exterminate a whole people. The word genocide was newly invented, but it described an old crime. Was it utopian to reach for a better way, for safeguards and protections which kicked in before such horrors gained any purchase? Was it cultural imperialism to seek to have such a thing? Could a universal declaration of human rights come into being that truly was universal? It must have seemed clear from the debate that night that there were certain universal intuitions, universal aspirations, which we do all share. Not everyone shares my view about this, I should say, but I believe that there are shared values. The human understanding that we are all one species and belong to a single tribe is comparatively new. While human life may have existed on the planet for millennia, it was the monotheistic religions that bound tribes together by preaching that all men were subject to one master, the Almighty. So we're talking about only a few thousand years of recognizing the very possibility of common humanity. It was not until the European Enlightenment that this religious intuition was secularized and it became common to think of all human beings possessing a common nature and a common set of moral obligations. What Eleanor Roosevelt wanted to do was to turn those moral obligations into something more than appeals to man's better nature. She wanted law. What are the things that we all share? What are the things that make us human? Some anthropologists might claim that societal differences are so deeply embedded that they make common modalities impossible. Yet all of us understand the life force that surges through us and know the value that we attach to our own life and to the lives of those we love. All of us know what it is to suffer pain or humiliation or degradation. We know happiness and we know loneliness. We don't have to experience torture or rape or abuse to know their effects and to understand them as more than an assault upon our embodiment. All of us yearn for love, to love and be loved. From the earliest age, human beings acquire a sense of fairness and justice and rage against unjust punishment. Try it on small children in the earliest stages of their education. They know what's not fair. There's a human yearning for meaning, which for many people gives rise to religious faith. There's a human desire for freedom and liberty. There's an urge to learn and make sense of the world around us. As the American Constitution declares, there are self-evident truths. However, the truths that we hold to be self-evident are also the truths that divide us. Before turning to these divisions, I want to reignite the excitement about the ambition of this endeavor. I like to imagine that at the end of that first evening, those lawyers stepped into the cool night air of New York, full of exhilaration and optimism. They must have known that they were involved in something which had the potential to change the world significantly. They probably also knew that, like the building of great monuments, it wasn't a project that would be completed in their lives. The days and months that followed were then when the hard work took place. This central core of lawyers expanded into greater numbers of lawyers from greater number of nations. They all recognized that the rule of law had to mean more than simply the obligation to abide by law passed by a nation's government or parliament. You know, if you go to China, they'll say to you that they operate the rule of law, but there's not an awful lot of protection of minority interests included. Too many German judges had claimed after the Second World War that they were only administering the law when they sent people off to imprisonment on laws that had been passed, which discriminated against Jews, against homosexuals, against other minorities. And they used that notion that they were only administering the law to exculpate themselves. There was also a fundamental recognition in the discussions that took place that within societies, minorities are often subjected to scapegoating by majorities, that they need protection from majoritarianism. A third defining principle was that not only could the state abuse human rights, but so could individuals. Your next door neighbor could be doing bad things to you as much as the state, but the state had a duty to act against those individuals to protect you. Now, what's interesting to me is that no nation came to the table with clean hands. Obviously, Germany had just been involved in an attempt to exterminate a whole people and was not present. But the Soviet Union was, and its gulags were already in existence. Opponents of the system there were systematically being sent off to Siberia. The USA still had Jim Crow laws. What are they? They denied black people their civil rights. The hangovers from slavery remained in all of the Americas, North and South. The United States of America and Canada had a sorry story to tell, each of them, on their treatment of indigenous people. Britain was still a colonialist power, with India and others champing at the imperialist bit and with an unhappy history of exploitation. That story was replicated in Africa. China had yet to have its Maoist revolution, and it may be that had the dinner party taken place a few years later, there wouldn't have been a declaration of human rights. They might well have used their veto, as they've just done in relation to Syria. However, what those morally compromised nations, and there was no one who was not morally compromised, and I suspect there's none of us can ever claim that we're not morally compromised, but they signed up to the Universal Declaration, and in doing so were accepting that in this process of securing human rights, the Declaration was an essential foundation. It spoke to their better angels. What they wanted was to create a moral universe binding all of us together. The throwaway contention that these values are Western takes no account of the fact that long before Tom Paine's Right of Man pamphlet, or the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, or the United States Declaration of Independence, Buddha advanced the idea that all humans are equal, as does indeed the Quran. King Darius of Persia granted freedom of religion to conquered peoples. The Cyrus cylinder, dating from the 6th century BC, recently loaned by the British Museum to Iran because of its regional significance, is often referred to as the earliest human rights document, as it established protections for prisoners of war. Fernand de Varenne has written quite extensively on human rights in Asia. And in his research of Asia-Pacific human rights documents and resources, he found that the Korean ruler, Yi Yul-gok, established the right to freedom of expression in the 14th century, seeing it as an essential to a society's success. In the oldest known Siamese writings in the 13th century, King Ramkhamhaeng the Great had stone slabs inscribed with rights. The right of everyone to be free, to have freedom of movement, freedom of thought, of religion and conscience, and freedom to participate in the free flow of commerce. There is evidence within his kingdom of the generous treatment of visitors, of justice being administered with fairness and without discrimination as to race or sex. So the idea that this is all somehow something that only came out of Western experience doesn't seem to hang true. After the First World War in 1919, the Japanese tried to have the League of Nations Covenant approve an amendment to Article 21 of the League of Nations Covenant, which was the first attempt to recognize equality and to prohibit discrimination in international law. What they wanted was equal and just treatment in every respect, making no distinction either in law or in fact on account of race or nationality. The place you'll find this is in a great book by Margaret Macmillan called 6 Months That Changed the World, and it's all about the Versailles Treaty. But the Japanese effort to get that included was not received with great relish. And the greatest opposition to the proposal came from, who do you think? Britain, the United States, and Australia. Lord Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, found that the notion that all men were created equal a rather strange idea. He couldn't accept it, and in fact is quoted as saying that surely a man from Central Africa could not be equal to a European. That wasn't that long ago, less than 100 years. While none of this is evidence that Asian societies are particularly amenable to human rights, what it shows is that many non-Western societies in Asia and elsewhere acknowledge the importance of some of the founding values which eventually emerged as human rights in the 20th century, long before the West did. By the end of the following year, 1948, after this great venture was embarked upon by Eleanor Roosevelt. By the following year, 58 countries had signed up to the declaration. 20 of them were Latin American, 3 of them were African, 14 of them were Asian. So non-European countries were very much part of the process. This was not all a European process at all. And out of those foundations, a great shift has indeed taken place. Nations around the world have adopted human rights conventions and introduced the concepts into their constitutions. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, despite backing from the UN Security Council, is not enforceable by law. As Professor Lauterpacht, late of this parish, a great Cambridge professor of law, inscribed on the hearts of lawyers who read his work. So the Universal Declaration isn't law, but what has happened is that it has been turned into law by constituent nations. And different people have done it in different ways. I think I've got my favourite bills of rights, if you like. I'm a particular fan of the Canadian Charter of Rights. I think that the South African Constitution and its Bill of Rights is absolutely one of the best human rights documents that exists. And the European Convention of Human Rights, to which we are signatories and which has now been incorporated into our law with the Human Rights Act, is in fact a very, very good document. And I, in fact, am more and more impressed with it the more I grapple with my position on the current British Commission to look at whether there should be a British Bill of Rights. It was just over 60 years, the impact of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights has been huge. The language of human rights is now in the tongues of heads of state and generals, as well as NGOs and individuals. Human rights have become part of our mental furniture. They're sometimes inflammatory, they're often controversial, and so they should be, given that they challenge our less wholesome instincts and the long-established power relations. They are a challenge, and that's what they ought to be. Now, this contestation, which is at the heart of human rights, I've got my pages out. For me, is actually a signal that we're seeing the maturation of human rights. You know, the fact that there is such grappling with human rights now, it seems to me absolutely how it should be. In fair weather, everybody signs up to human rights. But when the reality of human rights protections inhibit behaviours that have become commonplace or are convenient or are justified by longevity, or because they're part of our deeply held convictions, then battle lines are drawn. Human rights cause us to challenge ourselves, and that is not comfortable. It challenges atheists in their intolerance of religious faith. and it challenges those of faith who justify cruelty with passages from ancient texts. It challenges our secret prejudices, and it challenges male supremacy. Now, I'm in the Steven Pinker School, and he set it out in his recent book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, just published last year. And in that, his theory is that in the scheme of things, the world is a better, less violent place than it's ever been, which despite recent wars and mass rapes and killings in the Congo is obviously true. I mean, you know, yes, it is much better than it was, but it is taking the long view of history. Only recently, we had a Burns supper in my college at Oxford, as indeed I'm sure you have in many of the colleges here in Cambridge. And I took the opportunity of reading some of my favourite lines from Robert Burns. While Europe's eye is fixed on mighty things, the fate of empires and the fall of kings, which quacks of state, each producing his plan, and even the children lisping the rights of man, amid this mighty fuss, just let me mention, the rights of women merit some attention. So let's give them some attention now. Huge advances in human rights have undoubtedly taken place. But the project is still in its foothills. The utopian uplands are a long way off. While a human rights discourse has undoubtedly assisted the struggle for women's equality, overall, women still do not fare well internationally. The patriarchal nature of most societies militates against the full respect of the human rights of women. The second wave of feminism had yet to take place when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was created. Patriarchy is a system of power relations by which men dominate women, and I'm afraid history has shown that patriarchy is the most basic form of oppression within human society, and it's particularly hard, therefore, to dislodge. The ancient foundational texts of most religions and virtually all the laws of nations are riddled with patriarchal assumptions about womanhood, but also they're used to limit the lives of women and to justify discrimination. Since the Universal Declaration, of course, and then the great wave of feminism that took place in the late 60s and through the 70s, there was created the United Nations Commission for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, and it was established in 1979, and in 2008 it was relaunched as the Commission, the UN Commission on Women. So things have happened, really drawing our attention to women's rights as human rights. The developing nations often see human rights as the preoccupation of richer nations. And they say to us, well, you're not bedeviled by serious poverty and violent conflict in the way that we are. And you have placed the rights of individuals over the needs and the cohering values of communities. And some of those concerns that they express are absolutely true. But they also watch the hypocrisy of the rich North with regard to its own conduct and its indulgence of the conduct of countries with which it does business or has strategic alliances. Very forgiving of parts of the world that abuse human rights if it suits for economic or strategic reasons. The challenge is made to the West. Who are you to tell the rest of the world how to conduct their affairs? And the frequent claim is that human rights, as they are now being developed, are European secular concepts or a product of Western experience. Simply stated, cultural relativism refers to the view that all cultures are equal and universal values become secondary when examining cultural norms. My women lawyer friends, from Pakistan through Africa, in Latin America and in the Far East, in the Middle East too, would all say, never succumb to those arguments. They don't in their own places of struggle. And I'll go on to deal with some of those things in the lecture that I'm going to give tomorrow on globalization, but let's just consider this. If it were really true that we have to bow to cultural norms, and if we should be saying that no outside value should be deemed superior to that of the local culture, it would mean that local culture allows female circumcision, female genital mutilation, and the human right prohibiting cruel or degrading treatment shouldn't prevent that taking place. try to think really about what female genital mutilation means, what's involved in it. I'm afraid I know the detail far too well because of the work that I've done on this subject. But I mean, we're talking about the removal of the clitoris or the labia, and we're talking about the implications of that for women in health terms, but also in the terms of their own sexual fulfillment. If the culture accepts it, some would say, then no outside human rights principle should overrule that cultural norm. And they would say the same about women and girls being forcibly veiled in Iran under threat of imprisonment or lashes from the monitors of their behaviour. Strict cultural relativists would say that this is about religious respect and not a matter of human rights being abused. The problem, and it links to some of the things I was saying yesterday in a rather kind of, you know, different sort of context, but the problem with uncritical acceptance of cultural relativism is that it avoids examining the very societal structures that create that cultural norm. I'm going to say that again. It avoids examining the structures, the societal structures that create the cultural norm. Who determines the culture? He who decides controls the outcome, and I'm afraid it usually is he. The power to define culture, the power to determine religious and legal norms has rested with men. And not just any men, but the leading male power sources within those societies. And that's why we should be very careful about leaping to an acceptance of cruel practices without asking what their purpose is or was. What was the purpose of female genital mutilation? What was it for? And of course, what it all linked to was the property rights of men vested in women, where it was important that they retained their virginity, that no one could be seen to have contaminated the goods, and therefore by stitching up the vagina, by removing sources of pleasure for women, they were less likely, it was thought, to be promiscuous, and that when you handed over this property to a man who sought her in marriage, that she was virginal and therefore a prize to be obtained. When our Court of Appeal and subsequently the House of Lords heard a woman's case for asylum based on her facing enforced FGM on return to Guinea, a method justified as keeping women chaste, that was the cultural norm, it was proof of virginity on marriage, and there was also this argument that it made women more restrained. It made them better wives because temperamentally they were more passive. Part of the legal debate turned on the acceptance of the practice, not just by men, but by women within those cultures, as though endorsement of abuse by those who had hitherto been abused made it all right. And even our judges asked, is it persecution of women as a group? Because you have to be able to show that that it's a group within that society that is being persecuted. What is the persecution of women as a group when so many women accepted it as a practice? And in fact, in the Court of Appeal, it was very interesting. It was a court made up of two men and one woman. And the one woman was Mary Arden. And I remember discussing it with her, and I remember her describing her shock at the nature of the discussions. As they reached a decision, and she gave a dissenting judgment in that case, and it was the case of Zainab Esther Forna in 2005, and it went then to the House of Lords, and thank God for Brenda Hale, but the nature of the discussion was of a rather different order. Now, when I travel on human rights work to different parts of the world, I find sweeping resistance to human rights. I find that the people that I meet with, the men and women who are human rights lawyers and activists engaged in these issues, do not argue for cultural deference. In fact, it's usually governments who don't like human rights discourse because of the way it shines light on their conduct. Or it's male elders in communities who insist on preserving culture and tradition. And if you speak to usually a new generation of men, they often are people challenging these things too. Key issues which now inflame controversy and rejection of universalism are the death penalty, torture, freedom of expression, homosexuality, and women's rights. That's where most of the clashes take place, with different nations arguing their right to cultural difference rather than bow to any outside principle. Each one of those issues, which are raged over in other parts of the world, in America they have great battles around the death penalty, in Africa currently around homosexuality, and parts of the world over women's rights. Each one of those issues has a blowback effect here in the United Kingdom. The death penalty limits the United Kingdom's ability to deport, because we will not deport people to places where they will face the death penalty. In the same way, it puts a prohibition on us returning people who are here, even as illegal immigrants or whatever. We can't deport them if they are likely to face torture somewhere. We've just been having the whole business of Abu Qatada, and I'm sure that we can discuss that in the question and answers afterwards if it's something that exercises you. But the torture issue affects our due process fair trial obligations as well, because, of course, evidence based on torture, or which may be the product of torture, has been ruled contrary to human rights by our own highest court. Cases which my own chambers have been involved in. We have ourselves fallen foul of the human rights standards when we locked up non-citizens in Belmarsh without trial. On homosexuality, we here in the United Kingdom have chosen to interpret the right to family life as including a partnership with a person of the same sex, which has meant allowing immigrants to remain in the United Kingdom who formed committed relationships akin to heterosexual marriage. Men and women fleeing persecution because of their sexuality, because they will be persecuted in places like Iran, apply for asylum. And there's lots of people who feel that they don't want to be giving asylum to people. And there's always the talk of great swathes of people on the FGM one, on female genital mutilation, that the claim was that women in droves would be seeking asylum in Britain. But the majority of the women who experience this are poor, poor, poor women. And the idea that they're going to be able to flee anything is deeply unlikely. On women's rights, we've had to confront customs and practices which live on in other nations, but which we find unacceptable, including child marriage, the FGM one I've spoken about, forced marriage, honour killing, forced prostitution, any number of things. And again, there's a backlash against providing sanctuary and asylum to women fleeing these practices. There is a culture within the Home Office of disbelief, of refusing to accept women's accounts of their experience of rape when there's in situations of conflict, or of the abuses to which they're subjected in communities. Maintaining our commitment to human rights internationally has implications for immigration and asylum policy, and it's one of the main reasons why the concept of human rights is so antagonistic to the right wing of the Conservative Party. It's that immigration thing that is a particularly affront to their belief system. There are also large swathes of the right who hate anything that they think is European, and they're convinced that the European Convention is another of these pesky assaults from Europe on the English way of life. But even beyond the sort of little Englander position, there's a growing resentment about accepting rulings from supranational courts coming under the jurisdiction of foreign judges, raising that whole thorny issue of sovereignty. Now, as I've said, the ideology of human rights means recognising that certain moral and social values are above state sovereignty. And some people can't swallow that. And we should be very clear that some Western countries still have trouble accepting it. The United States refused to sign up to the International Criminal Court because it would not expose American citizens to its jurisdiction. But we've got to remember, and it's very important that we should remember, that most of the West held strongly to the concept of national sovereignty until the Second World War. I mean, it was one of those reasons why, in reaching some kind of settlement after the First World War, there was a resistance to anything that interfered with state sovereignty. But the Second World War was different. And basically, after the Second World War, there was a sense that something had to be done to protect people from human rights abuses. And so we saw this declaration coming into being, which allowed certain values to trump sovereignty in the right circumstances. And what's interesting to me is that now with globalization, we're seeing a retreat back into nationhood, where at least people feel that they have in some way control over something in the face of buffeting global forces. And so we're seeing more and more nationalisms developing. By and large, after World War II, most Western democracies accepted that it was no longer tolerable to insist on absolute sovereignty over the way that their own populations, for example, states might deal with their own populations. There was an acceptance of a sort of interdependence of the global community. However, the immigration issue particularly has inflamed hostility to human rights and to the European Court. Increasingly, the argument that the UK's sovereignty is being undermined is the argument gaining ground. Sections of the British press and of the Conservative Party are demanding that either the scope of human rights law be limited or the United Kingdom leave the European Court altogether. As a starting point, we have to ask, what does it mean to be human? We know that in the dark parts of some people's hearts, the other, the migrant, the foreigner, the prisoner, is still deemed sufficiently different to justify lesser protections. I'm afraid that in many parts of the world, women too are not given their full humanity. If women can be forced to have abortions, forced into sterilization, killed if they affront their fathers and brothers and dishonor the family, if they're flogged for wearing the veil in a way that doesn't fully cover their hair, if they're stoned to death if they commit adultery or have a baby outside of marriage, they are being treated as no more than chattels and are not being treated as fully human. Any legal system which contends that the testimony of a woman is of lesser value than that of a man has to be questioned as to whether women are being deemed of less value, less human. Interpretations of Sharia law, which elevate the testimony or rights of men above those of women, are in breach of human rights. Though it's vital to remember that the West did very much the same until recently. We required corroboration of women complainants' testimony in rape cases. Again, we were not willing to see women's truthfulness as being parallel to that of a man. Any legal system which considers the physical disciplining of women by their male family members lawful, or which sees rape as an offence against the property rights of men, fails to invest women with their full humanity. But our system too failed those tests until not very long ago. You know, it was the law here, as elsewhere, that, you know, if you, as long as the you beat your wife with something that was thinner than I think the width of your thumb, then that was acceptable. I am regularly still confronted by members of the public who feel that prisoners or alleged terrorists, you don't even have to be a convicted terrorist, but an alleged terrorist or a paedophile should forgo their human rights. And they're not always persuaded when I try to explain to them that being human does not mean being good. Our humanity is imperfect. We are all at times intolerant, vengeful, dishonest, violent, sometimes criminal. And if we commit crime, yes, we should be punished, but not denied our humanity. I also have to explain that human rights are not contractual and contingent on good behaviour or good citizenship. Frequently, politicians reach for the mantra that there should be rights and responsibilities, and I want to warn you against it. I'm all for shared responsibility, but it's an obfuscation and a denial of human rights principles to appease public opinion by pretending that rights should only be available to those who behave themselves. That was the whole point of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to acknowledge that a rationale will always be found for denying rights to those who are unpopular and despised. It may well be that the time is ripe for a discourse on social obligation, but it should not suck the air out of the discourse on human rights. All across Europe, the Roma people are loathed by huge tracts of Eastern Europeans. Political parties stand on platforms in parts of Eastern Europe wanting to deny them their rights. The whole point of human rights was to vest them in a person simply by virtue of our shared humanity, our shared membership of the human race. They're not just available to good citizens. And that's why they're different from civil liberties. The Americans are very big on the whole business of the rights that are vested in people by virtue of their being American citizens. But actually, the whole point of human rights was to vest it in people who are human. And it wouldn't matter whether you're a citizen or not. Human rights are not only available to adults, they're also available to children. People are not just available to people who have an average IQ, they're available to people who do not have that level of intellectual capacity. Nor are they only available to people of a particular skin color or sexuality or belief system. I'm very clear that human rights cannot be extinguished because of a claim that cultural tradition provides an opt-out. No human right in international law can be disregarded because of cultural differences, whether it involves torture, freedom of religion, or non-discrimination. However, a human rights standard which has a different impact in a particular country because of cultural or other considerations may not be a breach. And I'll give you an example of that. It should be rare, but I'll give you an example. And it's an argument where, for example, in somewhere like Africa, where after the atrocities in Rwanda, and people were put on trial for crimes against humanity, and it would take a century to try them in the way that we try people here in the United Kingdom or in most Western democracies. So what had to be resolved was to have trial systems that were tolerably fair rather than optimally fair. And I'm afraid we have invoked that on the grounds of prudence, because it was better to have those trials heard and heard soon. So you get large numbers of people on trial. It wouldn't be the way that we would want it, but at the same time, better to have a trial process than no process at all, which may have happened if law had not stepped in. There is an argument, and it's again, I mean, it's very interesting that people don't seem to understand the way in which the European Court of Human Rights works. There's been a big argument here in Britain over prisoners' rights to vote. And for me, it's a dishonest argument, because the politicians involved do know the truth. The ruling of the European Court of Human Rights said that a blanket ban on prisoners voting was contrary to human rights. And you have to think of why that is. The right to vote was contained in the European, it's not contained in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but it's contained in the European Convention on Human Rights, because the signatories were all democracies which committed themselves to the idea that a whole category of persons should not be disenfranchised. But it shouldn't be possible to say Jews can't have the vote or Roma can't have the vote. And so the concern would be that if we can do it to all prisoners, then other parts of Europe will start wanting to do it to whole groups of people. Had Britain said, listen, okay, you've made that ruling that we can't have a blanket ban on prisoners' voting rights, but we will only give the voting right to people who are serving sentences of under 4 years, or sentences for non-violent offences, that would have satisfied the ruling of the European Court, because of something that's called a margin of appreciation, which is allowed, and that would have been acceptable. So you have to ask the question, well, why? It was 5 years ago that the ruling was handed down. Why did Jack Straw not do it? And it was because he didn't want the Daily Mail to jump him in the run-up to an election. And that, unfortunately, is the way in which politics plays its part in the whole discourse on human rights. If a particular human rights standard contains the requirement of reasonable accommodation or an acceptance of rights being limited for reasons of morality or security, sometimes for health reasons, it means that a national context may sometimes validly be taken into account before deciding if there's been a breach of international human rights. So what we have to accept is that on occasions, you would look at the context in the same way that I was describing in the lecture last night. Sometimes in order to produce justice, you have to look at the context. Courts also accept that prison conditions in poor countries might be vastly different from what we are entitled to expect here. it's worth echoing the judgment in the what's called the Southwest Africa case, which was a case decided in the mid-60s by the International Court of Justice, that to treat equally in a mechanical way would be as unjust as to treat equal matters differently. However, such consideration of impact in a given country should not be used as an alibi to undermine rights, especially the rights of women. I think we have to take a hard line on any denial of equal status or opportunities for women to participate in public life, and particularly any treatment of women and children that involves physical assault or coercion or denial of female sexuality. Now, you know, there are issues like, for example, polygamy, and it's one of those practices which I consider a manifestation of gender inequality. But the struggle for change is going to be a matter for the women in those societies where that practice continues. But if there's any evidence of coercion, that turns that into a human rights abuse. What do we do about atrocities and systemic horrors that women face around the world? Do we leave it to the people of each nation to conduct their own struggles, as I've just suggested that we have to do in relation to polygamy? And I discuss this with my lawyer and judge friends in South Africa, where the president himself is a polygamist. What do we do about the fact that women are suffering so much? Do we just say these are domestic struggles? I'm told that the policy in the Department of DFID, the department that deals with international development in our own government, regards human rights black spots with strategic patience. Apparently that's the policy. Strategic patience. I'm going to give it great thought. I only heard it the other day. I think this means raising issues tentatively where possible and finding ways of making a difference or sowing seeds of change for the longer term. For instance, China acknowledges that the sale of children, and they are sold, that the levels of female infanticide and the abandonment of girl children are ongoing problems. And if you meet with Chinese politicians or senior people from China, they will admit the problem. But they address it, rather than addressing it as a problem about their family planning policies and their one-child policy, they put it down to backward thinking, feudal thinking in rural parts of China, and see it as backwardness rather than the product of policies by central government. So there may be a place here where constructive international dialogue could affect an outcome. I've told you about the whole female genital mutilation issue, and it's one that preoccupies me because I've been involved with it for a number of years, and I've visited parts of Africa and worked with women's human rights groups there. And inevitably, it's much better that it's taken up by groups, men and women, there rather than outsiders. FGM procedures violate the rights of the child, and all the leaders of the countries where it's practiced agree that it should be prohibited. I mean, at a senior level of government, they all agree. But in Sudan, for example, it has been contrary to law since 1925, and yet it's widely practiced. The rationale is that it's all local culture. And as I've realised because of my work in Ethiopia and in Somalia, the real answer to all of this is education. On most human rights issues, that is the answer. Exposing people to good information and letting them have access to it, and on FGM, it's about making the arguments that that it leads to terrible childbirth, higher infant mortality and mortality of mothers, rectal and vaginal fistula, that's tears, hemorrhaging, painful, unsatisfactory sex, often disability because of women ending up being unable to get up and walk because of it, because of tears in their rectal and vaginal area, that they end up often losing the power in some of their limbs. And it's when women realise the cost and the consequences, and their men folk do, that that you start seeing change taking place. But where we can affect real shifts is by effectively policing cultural practices that run foul of our own domestic law and human rights, while explaining clearly why human rights law matters. I mean, we'd still, I mean, in hospital, certainly in North London, dealing with administering to large Somalian populations, for example, a consultant obstetrician, obstetrics people will tell you that they'll see young women come in, they've been stitched up, they've had their labia removed and their clitoris, and they will tell them that they're going to have to be opened up in order to give birth. They're going to have an episiotomy. And what they will say to you is that they'll say, please stitch me up afterwards, please, because I want to please my husband. And the doctors will say, no, we don't do that. But the next time they come in, having baby number two, the vagina is back the way that it was. And so some folk out there are continuing to do this work. And while it may not be doctors, it's certainly happening in the community. And yet there's never been any prosecutions for doing this. To talk about the way in which we fail women. A few years ago, I represented a Bangladeshi girl. She was just turned 15. She'd been sexually abused by her mother's brother. She had been left behind when her parents came to Britain. She'd been left behind in Bangladesh with her grandmother. And her parents came here and then had further children. And she was only sent for when she was 13. And she arrived not speaking English, and she was used basically as a family skivvy, never sent to school, never allowed to go out of the house on her own. And you wonder how, you know, our immigration authorities are so interventionist when it comes to MDLs. Why, where, for example, a child arrives from Bangladesh to join the family, isn't there some mechanism to let the local authority know so that she can be schooled and so forth? Her mother's brother had sexual intercourse with her against her will whenever the family were out and she was at home alone, he being somebody who worked in a restaurant and not returning until the small hours and sleeping most of the day. And so he had sex with her, and she eventually became pregnant. She was too fearful, of course, to ever tell anybody. Nobody seemed to notice. She eventually gave birth alone to a baby girl in the bathroom of her parents' high-rise flat in Tower Hamlets. She couldn't possibly tell her parents what had happened. And out of her head with trauma, totally in despair, when her father was banging on the door to get into the bathroom where she'd just given birth, she threw the newborn out of the window. Now, the incredible thing was that baby survived, the baby that was thrown out. But she ended up on trial at the Old Bailey, charged with attempted murder. And the victim of crime, which is what she was being charged as a criminal. I was appalled. And I complained about the prosecution authorities that it was the wrong person in the dog and what was happening about the uncle. Why was she being prosecuted? And why wasn't more being done about the way in which she had been treated? Their answer was that they didn't want the community to think that it was all right to throw a baby out of a window. Well, I would have thought that it was rather important to let the community know that it wasn't all right to have men abusing girls and for no steps to be taken against them. Her mother refused to believe the account that it was the uncle who was responsible. Her father now viewed her as unmarriageable and wanted her sent back to Bangladesh. The infant child, who was the product of this abuse, was unwanted by the family and had to be taken into care. And her uncle, this young man who had abused her, disappeared into the Bangladeshi community and was given sanctuary. No one critical of his conduct. Now, of course, these things happen in every community's bad stuff like this. Novels are written about it. But the problem was, if I had not had the Newham Asian Women's Project working with me and had the help and backup from, for example, a wonderful group of women lawyers and practitioners called Southall Black Sisters, a fantastically courageous organisation tackling difficult issues in the minority communities, if I had not had them helping so that we could let the judge know and understand concepts of izzat, honour and sharam, shame, the ways in which my child had felt that she couldn't even tell anybody what was happening to her, the powerful cultural judgments that would be made within the community. And so basically, if we hadn't been able to introduce that into the courtroom, I think that it might have been much worse for this little girl that I acted for, who ended up being given a conditional discharge. The judge read the Riot Act in the court and said there are people who are blameworthy, who should be in the dock. But there was nobody there in the dock to hear it. All I can tell you is that we did secure a lenient sentence, But the admonitions fell on deaf ears. And we found out afterwards that the father of the girl had actually got in touch with the prosecution authorities and wanted to know whether it could be confidently said that there would be no prosecution of his brother-in-law. And that seemed to be the priority in mind. That young woman remained in care until she was 17 and is now making a life for herself here in Britain, totally detached and cut off by her family. So there are serious problems, and we have to make sure that we are courageous enough to talk about them publicly. The issue of forced marriages is another problem which I've had to deal with in recent years. And let me assure you that by talking about this, I'm in no way failing to indict, as I do all the time, the bad things that go on in the majority community. But I represented the mother of two girls from Birmingham very recently, and they had been taken by their Yemeni father back to Yemen, ostensibly on a family holiday, and basically they were married off while they were there. Both had babies within a year, 13 and 15 years old. And eventually, through desperate negotiation and the threat of legal action against an uncle who was basically based here but who'd been party to all of this, but also threats of action against the government, one of the girls was returned, but only by agreeing that she would leave her baby behind. And I can't tell you how painful it is when you spend time with somebody who's had to wrench themselves away from their child in order to flee from a life that she didn't want to be leading. Last year, the Foreign Office paid for 200 girls to return to the United Kingdom, having approached consulates to basically get away from marriages that were being forced upon them. So we have to have conversations about the ways in which human rights abuses take place in our own communities, but then they have, if you like, reverberations because they then continue a conversation back in communities from which people have come. These issues are fraught with difficulties. Particularly, I'm particularly conscious of this as somebody who does so much work with the Muslim community around terrorism, that the Muslim community is feeling very beleaguered because of hostility as a result of terrorism and consequent Islamophobia. And so the temptation for the community is to build even higher walls and to seek comfort in a sort of insularity. But the way forward has to be through open discussion and drawing upon the support of the majority of Muslims who in no way defend these violations of human rights. And I just want to say that it's by working with wonderful Asian and African women on these issues that I have learned immeasurably from them and know that they are the people who have the key to this. Now, there have to be some issues which are not negotiable, but through dialogue we can show that our own tradition is not without skeletons in the cupboard. All these things have been done within our system too, until not very long ago, and we haven't yet got it right on many of them. So no one has the high ground, and we all have to be in this together, and that's how we will make headway. And a large part of it, of course, is about education. Around the world, 62 million girls of school age don't attend school. The lack of education leaves women disempowered, and it limits their choices, and it keeps them in subservient roles, making them much more vulnerable to abuse. And in the long term, it's education that engenders human rights. Now, it's interesting to me that at the moment I'm working on a BBC radio series that I put forward to them on law and capitalism. And they've entered into this, and I've been interviewing lawyers and judges and different people about the development of the common law and its marriage to the development of capitalism. And what is clear to me is that universalism is perfectly achievable. Why? Because if there's a will, if there's a political will, it will work. Because we're seeing the creation around the world of universal commercial law. Because global markets need it. Urgency follows need. And we have to argue the cause of human rights as just as urgent, if not more so, and of necessity in a globalized world. The moral basis for human rights has to be re-argued every day. And for women, the struggle is even harder because of the multiple disadvantages women face. I love that John Rawl, the philosopher who's written about justice, has this concept, this idea of the veil of ignorance. And the veil of ignorance is that he invented this notion that if we placed ourselves behind a veil and people didn't know whether they were black or white, or whether they were male or female, or whether they were from the rich world or the poor world, or whether they were able-bodied or disabled, what would be the rules that they would create for living together in harmony? Do you think that they would create, if people who were making the rules on law thought that they might be a woman, that they would make laws that held women down? Do you think that in making laws, people who thought that they might not be able-bodied might not take that into account? It's an idea that I love. And so that is why our core principle has to be that every person is entitled to equal concern and respect in the design and structure of our societies. Desmond Tutu talks about the vital African concept of Ubuntu. I am, therefore we are. I am who I am through you. Our interconnectedness as human beings, our common humanity, is the foundation of human rights. When the tabloid newspapers and political groupings line up against human rights, it's time for all of us to speak out. Thank you.